release the Kraken.
Kraken's on steroid. We can't take enough victory laps. Hooray, hurrah, once again, the smartest man in the world, Proofcast, takes to the ether. This time from the salubrious confines of the Porpoise of Fruititude, the Fortress of Proofitude, located somewhere here in Lower California. Me llamo Gregorio, mi esposa es Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi.
The worm has turned.
Oh my God, we're winning and we keep winning. The GSA has to hand over all the documents and we're going to have the transition. Happy transition.
We finally made it. So many court cases. What it was? 35 lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits.
One described as
Frankenstein. One described as garbage by the judge. Thrown out. One told to never come back. We saw Giuliani before the Four Seasons Total Landscaping Company. We saw
a great moment
with
in
hair dye dripping down the side of his
running
face.
Running down his face.
We saw him with a woman who was described as the Kraken, who was then released from the Trump legal team and then described herself as the Kraken on steroids. And that was just this weekend.
Wow. The Republican Party's really distinguished themselves by having grace, dignity, pride, bearing, and really having a sense of probity going into this election.
Mm-hmm.
They did what they said they were going to do, which was have a psycho meltdown. And as you always pointed out, and this is the part that I enjoy so much, it's the death by a thousand cuts, so why not enjoy every victory?
Well, to hear that Biden won again. He won again.
He won again in Michigan today.
He won again and again.
And Georgia today.
Right.
Climb every mountain. Swim every sea. And that you say,
You mean that they're going to turn on each other?
Well, all the things that were promised that we're going to whisk this to the Supreme Court and have this white revolution in the streets, none of it materialized because it was, as everything in his mind, a magical fantasy that he thought of, like Willy Wonka or whatever, come with me, except that Willy Wonka did the work and there were everlasting gobstoppers.
Some of the judges that threw out these lawsuits in the last couple of weeks
it's like Frankenstein.
Were Trump appointees.
Yes, that'll give you
who looked at it and said, no, what are you even doing here? One of the suits was dropped by the lawyers themselves before the court case began.
Well, I think they saw their position at the bar and being able to practice law receding in front of them,
so
like grandpa at the Eskimo funeral. You're like, bye, see you, have a good time over the iceberg. What? No, it was having. Appointing Rudy Giuliani, as we discussed last week, as your chief legal officer is really like saying, I'm appointing Moby Dick in charge of the all activities on the ship from now on. I want Moby Dick to be the bursar. I want him to cook. It's not good, Bill. You're just hitching your wagon to the Lusitania. And it happened. And, I know that there's always things to worry about and we're always hysterical about everything.
But I feel like, we've had to talk people down.
Yeah.
And even in the last couple of days. In fact, even today, the carbohydrate wars continue on our street. And again,
I would
today,
say it's more of a long skirmish.
I feel like, and there's no turning back. I mean, I open my door and a pumpkin pie is thrust upon me.
But you had given them a bagels and a dozen cookies.
I did not.
I gave them bagels and a dozen cookies.
And they retaliated within hours with a pumpkin pie. And this is how it goes on our street. So we understand.
By the way, we played
legalities of the situation.
Exactly. This is like the Four Seasons Landscaping and Pleasure Island and the crematorium packed into one with a bakery. There's a lot of gambits with the baked goods. There's the Queen's Gambit. There's the there's been cupcakes. There's been pie.
Well, even our local restaurant has gotten in on this game because everyone's hysterical, and I think people are trying to do everybody a favor and do something nice. And the local restaurant where we get things, they've thrown in pies and cookies.
Yeah, they have.
And they can't stop. And I feel like I might have to cut back at some point.
I wouldn't do that, Jennifer. This is a pandemic. One of the things about the pandemic is...
The wine bar hours are posted.
Well, the honor bar is open, I think, 24 hours a day.
Right? It's very lenient.
Just sign your name to the book. Tell me what you took. And everybody's cool. There's outdoor, indoor situations. There's a flow to the entertainment area. The eating pavilion, as some have called it. Not us, but other people. Let's not bury the lead here. Let's get right to the... Yeah.
Yes, please.
Well, I mean, there was... You're living in your own house, like it's, or your own apartment, or your own, you know, squalid hovel, like it's at a vacation
home.
Well,
can I mention that one of our neighbors is addicted to decorating the exterior of his house, and he goes some way. And so
Halloween is quite an event. There's ghouls, there's goblins.
We spoke to him yesterday, and he was installing an inflatable Santa.
Santa's still resting on the tree, by the way. That's not completely inflated yet. I happened to know today.
A series of lights
Loads of lights.
There's unnecessary lights.
Oh,
there's lights
Rudolph
from trees. There's lights from, I don't think his neighbors know that he's climbing on their roofs, but he is. He is. He said that we needed to wait for, well, backtracking. He was talking about how he usually has a very festive Halloween gathering.
And yeah, we go over to his house and there's candy
and
for the children.
Out.
People come by in the neighborhood, whatnot.
And, you know,
when I say people, I mean trick-or-treaters.
A fog machine.
Yeah.
With
monster sound effects.
Monster noises. It's fantastic. And I thought of him on the night, you know, we can't go over, we can't hang out.
We can't drink wine.
But he's being really cautious. Most of the people on our street are being really cautious.
Yeah.
And on the upside, he said that the day after Halloween that he bought, 7 inflatable skeletons. So next year is going to be...
He bought them after Halloween.
7. He already has too many things going on.
I don't even know how to see what his garage looks like.
So I don't understand where the 7 skeletons are going to go, because there's witches hanging off of his roof there's things out of the trees and there's things that come out of the shrubs.
Oh, there's so much. And he told us they couldn't open up the patio. He moved everything outside. So everything's outside the perimeter now. So he's got what he would have in the yard and the perimeter. Now it's all outside the perimeter, which means twice as much.
He's dedicated.
There were ghouls that made noises.
The upside to being in Los Angeles is there's a lot of set decorators and designers.
It's so great. Everyone's so creative.
They need to really focus on their artistry.
Oh, no. Show business carries on no matter what. There's always people with great hair or great outfits, even during this. And like you say, there's so many set decorators. People do elaborate Christmas and Halloween things here. And people drive by them. Everybody knows and goes by them, which is great. Yes. There's even a This Is Halloween house. I can't remember if that's El Monte or somewhere, where the guy's got the whole song sings This Is Halloween and the house just keeps doing it. And people file in on bleachers and whatnot. It's just, I don't know about this year about bleachers. Cars.
Right, cars.
Cars are cool. This is car culture. We're in LA. Hi, my name's Greg. This is Jennifer. And
hi.
We're privileged, and we live here in L.A., but we're trying to get through this week. There's been a lot of wins today. First of all, this Emily Murphy entity that we've all been so upset with for the last 2 weeks because she's violating all of our rights to have a lawful transition, and why are they doing this? Obviously, they're doing it because they could. This is going to be the new gold standard. They're always going to act petulant about every giant election like this.
It's not going to be the new gold standard. It proved that they had nothing.
Doesn't it? I think
that it also highlights... I think much to their chagrin, it has highlighted where this new administration is going to seal up the loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, in fact, wasn't any law by which the Democrats could do anything about the GSA holding this up. So I think that might be solved in this Biden administration.
Right. And as you said to me before, not in these terms, it puts 1,000 copper nails into his victory. Instead of destroying society at the seams and picking away at democracy and being an avalanche of white supremacy that overwhelms us, I feel like what you feel. It's actually a legal case that shows that they have no legal case when they try to do autocracy, that it's a losing cause.
I know that...
I sounded like Tony Randall there. They can't do autocracy, Jennifer. It's a losing cause.
Well, I think a lot of people were worried that these lawsuits were undoing democracy. There was a lot of hysteria. And I felt like the wins each day, coupled with there were actual recounts. Mm-hmm. And for me, that reaffirmed that the votes are being counted.
Yes.
Again and again, in fact. And that it was this important that everyone showed up, that I would probably, since they're accusing our team of voter fraud, of voting mishaps, that I would look on that side, and I'm sure we're going to uncover that Biden's margin is even greater. But it's already a near historic proportions.
What about Mr. Bex, was it, who got fired? And Mr. Spansberger in Georgia? Mm-hmm. They're Republican and not particularly, you know, they have come forward. When it's just a threat against democracy, we've seen Republicans who normally, Brian Kemp, who was accused of stealing the election, and quite rightly, from Stacey Abrams when he was Secretary of State, has had to come forward and say that his vote counts legitimate.
That means it's a sinkhole. They're standing in the middle of a sinkhole.
Right. And when a reliable ally like that,
they're grasping
says to you,
for a branch.
We're losing by 12,000. You have to accept it. We've counted every vote twice now. Twice. By hand the second time.
If you can't see the writing on the wall in this country and that the demographics have changed and that people are motivated to vote and that we understand the process
and
let's get to Biden's administration
please.
Who he has.
Well, he's talking about Janet Yellen for Treasury.
Yes.
And she was the first woman at the
she was the
Federal Reserve.
Former Federal Reserve chairwoman.
Jewish.
She will be the next Treasury Secretary. She's the first woman to hold that position as she was when she was the chair of the Federal Reserve.
She hasn't held it yet. But yes, she will be.
Right. She hasn't held it yet. So these are all
historic.
His appointees. Antony Blinken, we were just watching him on France 24. He is Biden's choice for Secretary of State. He's fluent. The reason we were watching him on French news is because he is fluent in French. And
he grew up in Paris and New York.
Well, he did go to school. He didn't grow up in Paris, but he did go to school there.
I did too briefly, but are we talking about Paris, Texas?
And his stepfather had been in the Holocaust.
Yes.
Alejandro Mayorkas is Biden's pick for Homeland Security.
That's so awesome.
He was born in Havana. So, and his family's also Jewish.
Did you say Cuban Jews?
His mother's family was Romanian.
This reminds me of Jeremy Kramer. Jews and Cubans,
right?
Jews and Cubans.
Go together like cigars and
Rubens. You can't have one. You can't have one.
So, I mean, Antony Blinken is a fantastic choice for Secretary of State.
He was Deputy Secretary, and Mr. Mayorkas was also Deputy Secretary.
Right. These are people that Biden has worked with before. As Senator Kamala Harris said today, these are people that are crisis tested. And this is what we need because the Trump administration had shortened the transition period. All these people are ready, have worked with Biden before. They know the score. They know how. And when we're putting the team together, it's 4 years out, and we're going to right this ship. And it's just awesome. Alejandro Mayorkas.
Kind of man.
As the U.S.
So big and so strong. Alexander Mayorkas.
As the U.S. attorney,
so
he
long.
Created the civil rights section to prosecute hate crimes and other acts of intolerance. He was deputy of Homeland Security during the Obama administration, where he was focused on cybersecurity.
And DACA, is it not?
He helped develop DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, which is something that the Trump administration really tried to destroy.
Oh, yeah.
And so I can't think of anyone better placed for this. He was recommended by Dianne Feinstein and appointed by President Clinton to U.S. Attorney for Central District of California, where he was the youngest U.S. attorney in the nation. So we're also with Janet Yellen and that getting a whole lot of California and Bay Area love because Janet Yellen was head of the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco.
They're all from the Bay Area.
Well, they're not all from the Bay Area.
A couple of them.
But there's a lot of it. Avril Haines is his choice for...
What's that flower you've got?
National Director of National Intelligence. She would be the first woman to head the intelligence community.
Right.
She was White House Deputy National Security Advisor in Obama's administration. And that this is awesome about her. She has a degree in physics. She lived in Japan, and she worked as a car mechanic.
What?
Yeah.
I'm so close on this.
Linda Thomas Greenfield.
Oh, my God. Career.
Is, yeah, a career person who has been appointed to be our representative to the UN.
Will she be the first black woman representative from the United States at the United Nations?
Is she?
I believe so.
She's,
we had Jean Kirkpatrick, of course.
She's
and Nikki
a
Haley.
35-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Services and much beloved by everyone. She's from Louisiana and was ambassador to Liberia and director general of the Foreign Service. And this is the thing that is the big FU to the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. 5 days into Trump, she was let go. And so she's right back there 4 years later as our person at the UN.
This is all history, you guys. The first black woman, South Asian woman, vice president.
Don't let anyone tell you that this is a disappointing choice. These people are so impressive.
Yeah. First Latina, first immigrant to be secretary of DHS. First woman director of DNI. First black woman UN ambassador. It's really awesome.
Jake Sullivan is his
choice. By the way, he's in. He doesn't have to be approved by the Senate.
Or John Kerry. Jake Sullivan is national security advisor. He's only 43. He was national security advisor to then Vice President Biden. Again, somebody that he's worked with that knows the score, knows what's happening. Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Who?
And we know that Hillary Clinton was the first Secretary of State, perhaps the only, to have gone to every country.
Oh, yeah. She went to 253.
John Kerry will be the special presidential envoy for climate with the National Security Council. And by the way, he's the architect of the Paris Climate Accord, which he signed in 2016 at the UN, and which, of course, Trump decided that he shouldn't be a part of.
He was my second favorite Secretary of State during the Obama administration after Hillary Clinton, because I thought he was an erudite and accomplished diplomat, much like her. He had a great deal of charm. He didn't have her magnetism.
And should have been president, much like Hillary Clinton.
Both of them were elected president.
Yes, yes. I think history will bear that out. And also look at how many... We said Antony Blinken is...
What about his brothers, Lincoln? And really?
Don't go there. It's already been trod upon.
It's low-hanging fruit.
He speaks fluent French,
does
John Kerry.
Yes. Where?
As does, of course, Senator Kamala Harris, because she went to school in Montreal.
We are going to have such a great conversation.
But, I mean, to bring... our foreign relations back to some semblance
of détente
or even détente.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That was, who was the comic? That was patronizing. I think you'll find that's patronizing.
Patronizing.
Yeah.
The black women who made historic gains in Washington state politics in 2020. The number of black women in Washington's legislature will triple next year, And
from none to three.
Washington State just elected a black woman to Congress for the first time. It's just phenomenal. The State House will gain three new black women, Jamila Taylor, April Berg, and Kirsten Harris-Talley. They will join two black female incumbents, State Reps Melanie Morgan and Deborah Entenmann, who were reelected. And Twyna Nobles will be the first black state senator Washington has had in a decade. Then on top of that, former Tacoma Mayor Marilyn Strickland will be its first black member of Congress.
That's fantastic.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
This is, I mean, these are inroads. These are so important. And it's really lovely to see that these women are running for office. They're getting elected. A change is being effected. There's a local teen from Los Angeles. He's from Compton. His mom was raising him on his own. His dad is in prison. He's still in high school. Mm-hmm. He's going to Harvard. And yesterday...
Oh, no.
Yesterday, he has won a Rhodes Scholarship.
Oh, my God. That's so awesome.
His name is Elijah Devon right. Jr. And he said he was inspired by his mom, who's a teacher. And hard work pays off. And what an amazing young man he
right?
is.
That's astonishing. The first female CHP commissioner was appointed this week, Amanda Roy, here in the state of California. The CHP is our state police, as they call them in so many states. But we call them the California Highway Patrol.
I think they have the fifth largest budget in the nation.
It's a giant
policing.
Paramilitary force. Yeah,
yeah.
California.
So to change it up for a woman and a woman of color.
Yeah.
Is so important.
91 years there's been a California Highway Patrol. She replaces Warren Stanley, who was there for 38 years. Earlier this year, she made history, Ms. Ray, when she became the first black woman to be named deputy commissioner for the nation's largest state-run police agency, because California's huge. There's a YouTube chapter, or channel, rather, for the Negro Leagues Museum, and it's at Pro Athletes, Inc. It's called Storied. Mm. And our good friend Bob Kendrick tells stories of all these different Negro League players. We've watched several of them, and they're fantastic. The Negro League Museum is trying to stay afloat during the pandemic, and they're most worthy because they talk about...
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And he's at at NNLMB.
He's a beautiful storyteller.
Oh, Bob Kendrick. I think you'll really like them. I mean, I'm not going to play one, but it's really good. It's at Pro Athlete, Inc. Let's see. Me and Ben Glebe, we got a thing going on. I don't know if it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let us go now. Me and Ben Glebe do a G thing, November 28th, 6:30, prolific daylight smine. Pacific Daylight Time. You can go to gregproops.com and find it. We're at the Nowhere Comedy Club. It's also on Eventbrite, 6:30 p.m. Him and me are going to riff. Then December 9th, it's a Proopcast. The same thing, 6:30 p.m., my time. Your East Coast time may vary. That's Eventbrite, or you can go to gregproops.com. We're doing a holiday special with Ryan and Joel and Jeff and Bob Durkach is going to play.
Will there be decorations?
Well, look at the poster. We're all wearing Santa hats. You know that I have lots of lights and Santa hats. In the meadow, we will build a snowman, and we'll pretend that he is Parson Brown. If he's Desmond Tutu, we'll say, whoa, man. This is super awesome when you came down.
Really?
What? I'm going to wear my Christmas outfit. I don't wear like a red or green or anything like that because I don't think I look that good in it. for me, I go
just a little tinsel,
right? I go Bob Hope. Silver bells. What?
What?
Yeah, I'm going to be dressed in what can only be described as I don't know if you remember the outfit from Domo Origato, Mr. Roboto by Styx, but the Christmas version.
I'm very happy to say I don't remember that at all.
There's not. I'm not going to do it. I'm having a Santa hat because I have several, as you know. Some have yours. This is on December 12th. I don't know if you've ever experienced Christmas before. I don't know if you've ever been to England or any of the Scandinavian countries where I think it's...
England or the Scandinavian countries?
Well, you know...
Lindisfarne?
I think a lot of times Christmas stories are bent toward white people's Christmas as opposed to
just
everyone,
a little.
Everyone else's Christmas.
What about Saint Nicholas in the southern part of Turkey?
He would come to your house, and he would leave presents for women. Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was a young woman that didn't have a dowry.
Saint Nicholas would come. We went to his church in the south of Turkey, and I found there some final. What do they call it? Conclusion? What's the word?
I really don't know.
Yeah, no, where you find the cessation, you know, you find the end of the thing you're struggling for.
Really?
Yes.
There you found it.
What do you call it? What do you call when you...
Some kind of absolution?
Well, no, it's not absolution. That's... Wow. I didn't realize you were studying under Pope Francisco. That is... Mm-hmm. I think Guns N' Roses put it best.
Can I talk about...
Oh, well, I'm not done with this, but yes. Of course you can. Whose Line Anyway presents Improv Masterish Clash. Why am I plugging this so hard on December 12th at 5 p.m. our time? Because Colin Mochrie is our special guest. And then someone else will be there, too. I don't know who they are.
Well, that'll be fun.
Well, thank you. I think it will be, too. Colin and I were in a knife-toting gang in T.O. in the 80s. And we had to fight a gang called the Warriors all the way back from Lake Huron on this one conclusive weekend evening during Dominion Day. It was hectic. Wounds were taken and scalps were taken and whatnot. But we got back. The rest, as they say... Fucking history, right?
Yes?
What do you got? Jan Morris?
Well, I was going to talk about... We've discussed before how we should rename all of the Army bases.
So that they're now named after slave-driving
white
supremacists.
Well, so that they could be named after heroes instead of traitors and horrible, racist pigs. So the Washington Post had an amazing article by Alex Horton about Staff Sergeant Roy Roy Benavides, who in 1968 did the impossible. And when I say impossible, I mean, the story is, I won't even go into the details because you must look it up for yourself.
Give me the highlights.
If you're interested, because it is just unbelievable.
No, not one moment of it's believable.
Benavides has become the most prominent candidate in the campaign to rename the Army's largest post, Fort Hood, which is in central Texas.
Oof.
Proponents have said renaming the post after Benavides, the son of a Mexican-American sharecropper and a Yaqui Indian mother, would also help draw attention to the contributions of minority service members, which is so long overdue. His call sign was Tango Mike, that mean Mexican.
What?
He had only a knife with him.
Not a gun?
When he arrived on a battlefield without a rifle and left with 8 survivors, May 2nd, 1968, he leapt from a helicopter onto a battlefield. The team had lost several men, including its leader, and everyone else was wounded by the time Benavides arrived. He was shot twice, including in the face, and his body was pierced with shrapnel before loading several wounded men onto the helicopters. He was carrying the leader, Sergeant Leroy Wright, to the helicopter when he was hit in the back. Then that helicopter was hit. It was 6 hours before another helicopter rescued them. And
you're truncating
skating
this.
Over a lot of hectic.
Yeah.
When medics arrived, and this is the cake-taking part, because this man is already, he's single-handedly saved, like, to Shira Mifune, saved everyone. When medics arrived, they thought he was Asian and stuffed him into a body bag.
What?
Another wounded soldier alerted a doctor that Benavides was an American. Benavides recalled in a speech years later, "When I felt that hand from the medic on his chest, I made the luckiest shot I ever made in my life. I spit in the doctor's face."
Wow.
Because he had to prove he was alive.
Right.
I mean, after all that, as Brian O'Connor, a Green Beret on the ground that day, wrote, the medal he showed borders on the realm of the humanly impossible. There's a national rights group called the League of United Latin American Citizens who want to rename Fort Hood after Sergeant Roy Benavides, who died in 1998. There had been calls to rename it before, once from Fort Hood, once in 1945, but its commander feared, quote, undesirable popular and political repercussions in Texas.
Yeah.
One wonders what that might be. If Benavides knew about a campaign to rename Fort Hood for him, his son said he'd probably crack a joke about it because he was really that guy.
Yeah.
He was humble and funny.
Unbelievable
his story,
Jennifer.
Yeah, his story is just cake-taking.
Wow. That's a really fantastic beyond all measure.
Speaking of cake taking, Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton spent $1 million to
Dolly
she gave $1 million to Vanderbilt.
You surprised me on this one.
For vaccine research.
Okay.
And Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville is part of the Moderna vaccine trial, which is nearly 95% effective. Also, really? Who knew that Dolly Parton would appear in this? The other vaccination that has been developed in Germany, which is, what is that one called?
As I
the BioNTech, but
right.
There's another name for it.
Azenicar.
The couple behind it are from Turkey. So they're Turkish immigrants to Germany. And their story is really amazing. And I came across that in the local. They wanted to help cure forms of cancer. And they ended up with their team being able to come up with a COVID-19 vaccine. And their headquarters in Mainz, which we've been to.
Yes.
It's a quaint and curious town. And
a beautiful river and the apex of the Roman Empire during the 2,000 years
and
ago.
And there's a Gutenberg's museum there.
Gutenberg's Bible was printed there. It's a very historic place, yeah. And lovely.
What I love about this couple...
Idyllic summer afternoons and whatnot along the Rhine, as I recall.
Again, they are a devoted immigrant couple, and they specialize...
Just an immigrant.
They specialize in molecular medicine and immunology. They married in 2002, and they even returned to the lab on the day of their wedding.
That's dedicated.
But if your goal is
to
this...
Cure.
And they've come up with a COVID-19 vaccine. It's awesome.
By the way, the news is not, you know, sparkly, frosty good. So it behooves all of us to take part in society. And that means wearing a mask the minute you go outside, no matter where you're going, no matter what you're doing. And to try to limit it. I know if you have to work outside, I respect you and I understand that. If you have to be an essential worker and drive a bus, be a nurse.
But you have to look after yourself and do as much that you can to take care of yourself and others.
But for everyone else that has the privilege of staying at home, you really must. The next few months are going to be pretty wild. And
I don't want to see privileged people outdoors at restaurants without masks. Yeah, it's not good for anybody.
Or stores or, you know, whatever. I think everyone has to take into account that we have to be responsible for one another. As Dolly Parton, you quoted earlier, when we rely on each other, from one lover to another, I think you have to take it on board that it's not some fantasy or whatever. If two people are wearing masks at the same time when they encounter one another, it's mitigated to a point where you're safe.
But you don't want to be indoors with people right now that you don't know. It just is, there's no control. And you have to wait it out as much as you possibly can. I know it's really hard.
It's really hard.
And we were talking with one of our neighbors yesterday about how hard it is for his friends who are alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really difficult. And that's why you need to reach out. And if you can phone people, that's super important right now.
I don't have a phone.
Really?
I have a couple of pigeons, Dom and Perignon. I give them messages and whatnot.
Did you say Dom and Perignon?
Yeah.
Wow, those are privileged pigeons.
Gray and Poupon. My pigeons are.
That's right? Stretch and a sketch.
Super stretch and a sketch.
Lynn Conway worked for IBM.
Mm-hmm.
And 52 years ago, she was fired for being trans. She was going through the transition. She was becoming a woman. And they just apologized to her. They were, in fact, because she was such as they put it, a tech trailblazer, they were doing an event where they were honoring her and her time at IBM. But during the event, they finally decided to apologize to her.
Oh, my God.
But it was 52 years later.
She's still alive?
Yes. Thank goodness. She didn't expect that IBM would confess to firing her during her transition after this is even more ghastly. They promised to support her.
Yeah.
And then they fired her.
Mm-hmm.
They apologized for how they treated her 52 years earlier. I wanted to say to you here today, Lynn, for that experience in our company and all the hardships that followed, I am truly sorry, said Diane Gerson, an IBM Senior Vice President of Human Affairs. Thanks to your courage, your example, and all the people who followed in your footsteps, as society, we are now in a better place. But that doesn't help you, Lynn, probably our very first employee to come out, and for that, we deeply regret what you went through. Conway is 82. When she was fired, she had to go on welfare. But by 83, she was recruited to lead a supercomputer program and elected to the National Academy of Engineering in 1989. She's now a mentor for others. They are leading the company in this, which is amazing, she says. She expected the company to merely admit this happened and they know about my work. And then they would jointly celebrate how far we've come. And she didn't expect them to apologize. But how gracious of her to say that.
Yeah. That's extraordinary.
And, you know, you can look, her list of accomplishments is long.
Yeah, epic. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Which leads us to Jan Morris, who swirled away at a grand old age of 94. And I was listening to...
How far up Everest did she get to before she swirled away?
I was listening to her Desert Discs. This evening, and she said in 83 that each year she was told that she climbed higher.
On her desert island disc?
Yeah, but I think that it was 23,000 feet mm-hmm. that she accomplished. And I was listening to what she said.
How high is Everest? 25?
She was saying how they got the information.
Mm-hmm. How did they?
Well, it was fun. She was the only reporter,
yes.
By the way.
Here, with, set with, the whole scene.
Yeah, okay,
set
let's the whole start scene. The
start
beginning.
Again. Start again. You can't just start talking about the 53 conquest of Everest.
No.
So the most famous white people mixed with Nepalese.
Well, not just white people.
I said.
Jan Morris was a historian and a travel writer, although she...
And a transsexual.
She liked to say that it was about place and people, not travel. She was also a trans pioneer, and she was 94. She has so many great books. One of them was her memoir about transitioning, which was Conundrum in 1974. She said, "I reached the conclusion myself that sex was not a division but a continuum, that almost nobody was altogether of one sex or another, and that the infinite subtlety of the shading from one extreme to the other was one of the most beautiful of nature's phenomena." And I read an interview with her from earlier this year where she said that she thought that she was a pioneer in that she thought that gender was very fluid. And I thought that was beautiful.
Right.
The author and traveler Jan Morris began her greatest journey. She leaves behind on the shore her lifelong partner, Elizabeth. And that was from her son, Tom, which is Welsh. So it's spelled T-W-M, and I believe it's pronounced Tom.
T-W-M? I love the vowels there.
When she made the transition, and by the way, this was after being in Nepal, after living in Egypt, after being all over, she went back to Wales, which is where she felt the most connected, even though she was born in England. Her mother was Welsh. "The villagers greeted my moment of metamorphosis with an urbane insouciance. It was instructive to see how well the Welsh coped. Some tactfully said how well I looked that morning, but most with that accomplishment of performance, which is the national birthright, simply pretended not to notice. Spoke to me as they always did, asked after the children, and by the skill of their pose put me at ease." Isn't that beautiful? She and her significant other had 5 children.
Wow.
And they had to divorce. Jan Morris didn't want a divorce, but they had to because she wasn't allowed to be married to her after she transitioned.
Illegal.
And then they were finally allowed to become a civil couple. She wrote that she was 3 or 4 when she was listening to her mother play Sibelius. And she realized she should really be a girl. And the kind of casualness that she describes how she felt about that, that she just knew it to be true. Tim Adams at The Guardian interviewed her in March of this year. She was living with her wife in an 18th century barn near where they'd raised their children. Jan Morris was 26 when she was the only journalist to accompany Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay on their 1953 ascent of Everest. At other times, she wrote about living on Field Marshal Montgomery's family houseboat on the Nile and in a palazzo on the Grand Canal. She met Che Guevara in Cuba. She visited Hiroshima after the bomb, and she reported on the trial of Eichmann in 1961. In her dreamy books about cities, most memorably Venice and Trieste, the world can seem a permanent Xanadu. You can find her book about Venice for free online, which is astounding. And to get back to the Desert Island Disc, in 83, she was talking about her time with Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, and because they weren't allowed for security purposes apparently to have other kind of equipment, she was the only reporter with them, and they were relying on locals to run things down.
Right. So from where they landed at the top, which is several thousand feet above where...
So the last point where Hillary and Tenzing Norgay had gotten to the top.
Yes.
In order to...
Someone has to come back.
Jan Morris decided, I think, she herself, that she would encrypt the message.
Right. It was coded. So that no one
England.
Could say, made it to the top of
Everest. Well, she realized that anyone could have the story. And so she put it in code, which was something like, we're quite well up here in the snow or something. And so a Nepalese army person got that message through to England.
But ran
and
it back.
Right. And it happened to come through on the day of the Queen's coronation.
In 1953, which was a big year for Britain.
Which is...
They included Hillary, though he was New Zealandish, as an English person, like they do.
Well, if, as they do.
Well, who's our Scottish tennis star? And
Andy Murray.
Andy Murray. And Greg Tenenbaum. They often reach out and include... Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that is just... Jan Morris's whole life is profound, and her writing is beautiful. And when I was reading about her, she had this wonderful house in Wales, and she also had photos of her dream man, Jack Fisher, who she said she was going to have an affair with in the afterlife.
Jack Fisher?
Which I thought that was beautiful. This you're not going to believe, because I don't think you know this one. She spoke about going as a reporter to the Bristol docks with the Times to meet a big band sent to entertain the U.S. troops.
Right.
Irving Berlin was with them.
What?
She said, he was terribly kind to me, so I have always thought of him ever since as the ideal American. Isn't that awesome?
Oh, Irving Berlin, that's so great.
2 years ago, she said, kindness is the answer to all our problems. It lies at the core of beauty. The more we come to aim towards universal kindness in the widest possible sense of the word, the nearer we come to peace and reconciliation.
Jan Morris, irreplaceable.
Right? What a beautiful person.
The experiences are so wild, and the self-recognition is so profound. That's really awesome, Jennifer.
Isn't it? Mm. I mean, there's just great story. I mean, it's just, you peel back another layer, and there's, I mean, the Irving Berlin story.
Right. How was Irving Berlin there? What?
There's many interviews with her that you can see on YouTube as well. It's just awesome.
Jan Morris will fly high in the friendly sky. Matthew McConaughey.
Wait, really? We're making that transition?
No, there's no transition. Matthew McConaughey is a publicity machine that somehow went on TV this week. This is what I love about media, Jennifer. Someone, I think it actually says here something like, answers the rumors, the possibility that he might run for governor. I don't remember any rumors that Matthew McConaughey would run for governor of Texas.
I think we stopped at the Kraken.
Right? When I released the Kraken, or when I unleashed the Kraken.
I didn't unleash the McConaughey congas.
Jennifer, let me tell you something.
What does he do in the one movie?
If nominated, I will not run. We're going to get there. If nominated, I won't self-serve.
Couldn't he just be in charge of like a barbecue?
Jennifer. I'll tell you what I'm in charge of.
He could throw a beer from a balcony in New Orleans.
Jennifer, do it with me. Hockaloopy, 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 hockaloopy. Make it happen. Make the harmonic convergence happen. I'm going to run for governor. And then I'm going to run for senator after that.
No.
Right? And then I'm going to run for field marshal. Who's with me?
Come on. Yeah, this is
it. And then... wide receiver, bow.
Why don't you just give him a title? He'll believe it. Send him off somewhere.
I love Matthew McConaughey. There's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing you can do about Patrick Swayze.
I know your sick love of Patrick Swayze.
I know. A very dear friend of ours pushed off to the excesses of the regions of heaven that are reserved for those who are most sublime. John Sessions was someone that Jennifer and I both knew, and was a rare comic talent.
Wasn't he?
Wasn't he just? John Sessions is at once... you're drawn to his immediate genius and the intrinsic impromptu enormity of what he brings forward. Not only was he great at impressions, he had, you know, a zillion impressions. He was a marvelous impressionist. It was the intention and the intellect that informed his impressions that made him singular in British comedy in the time period.
Quick.
We got to meet him in... I was there in 89, and Jennifer came over in 90, and we met him. And the first time I did a gig with him... What was the name of that... I went and bought a suit for my first Whose Line show in 1989. I got on the show. And the first episode I did was with John Sessions and Josie Lawrence and Tony Slattery. And there's an awesome photo of us all. And I went to a secondhand store on Haight Street in San Francisco. And what was the name of that place? It wasn't called Decades or whatever. And I bought this oatmeal-covered suit. It wasn't covered in oatmeal.
Or colored. Oatmeal-colored suit.
You cut me to the quick, Jennifer. It was colored as if it was oatmeal. It was a beautiful brown suit. And I bought a vintage tie and whatnot. And I had the shirt. And I brought it all to England. And I got there to do the first show. And then I realized I was up against Josie Lawrence and John Sessions and Tony. Which made my game go, oh, I need to stretch. And I had two different pairs of glasses. I brought a brown pair of horn rims with me and another pair that I can't remember the shape of. And John came in the dressing room, and he was really nice. And this was the first time I met him. We did the rehearsal together and whatnot. And he came in and he goes, look, there's a dressing room. There's a bed in there. If you can get a bit of kip if you want.
That's
and
sweet.
Kip means like a 10 minutes sleep,
yeah,
15
nap.
Minutes. Yeah, a little nap. And I said, thanks. I don't know if I said thanks, mate, at that point. And then he goes,
he was a bit warmer than some of the others.
Really warm. He came to me immediately and was most supportive. And he was the star of the show. It was called John Sessions with the Rest of Us in 1989. And I had two different pair of glasses, and I took one out, and I said, what about this one? And John went, that's a bit ornithological convention in Omaha. And I went, well, that's rather specific. And so I wore the other pair. And
years later, we were at Clive's birthday party.
Oh, yes.
And
at the Royal Courts of Law.
Yes, very, very memorably. And Peter Cook came in.
Yeah.
And he came over and he made the rounds and he shook our hands. And I turned to John, and John Sessions and I leapt up and down.
Yeah.
He and I were so excited to meet Peter Cook, and he was absolutely that person. He and I shared a love of the Stones. We could go
Keith
on
Richards.
For days.
And how many times did you do Keith Richards on Stella Street?
Right. And, well, right. On Stella Street, he was doing, the other guy was Michael Caine.
Right.
He was Keith Richards. It was just hilarious. The idea that Mick and Keith would have a corner shop selling essentials.
We need more Lugo.
In London. Dirk Bogard in the neighborhood.
Just fantastic.
But he and I had a lot of the same favorites. And the last time I saw him was bizarrely in Aspen, Colorado. And you and he and I had a long lunch.
Yeah, we did.
And then afterward, he and I were hanging out in the hotel. We were talking, of course, about Dirk Bogard, I think, for a year.
Right.
And John Podesta came in.
Yeah. John Podesta.
To give you an idea of the strangeness.
What was going on?
John Podesta did not give me any gnocchi tips.
No, did he not?
I like to complain about that. He was really nice. But I remember John was reading a tome of some kind of severity. I can't place it. I was trying to think if it was FDR's letters. It was some kind of, you know, like, this is what you're bringing on vacation.
Well, how many prime ministers did he play?
But
he played all the prime ministers. He played Heath.
But John was that person that, of course, that was what he was reading in Aspen.
Well, he was a bloody marvelous actor, and he was a bloody marvelous comedian.
I do remember one time I ran across him in Soho, and he was on stage in the West End at that time. And we just crossed paths. And I didn't expect him to just stop and talk to me, but he always did. He always had time to... he was from Scotland. I think half of his family was Jewish. He was gay. I think things were never easy for him.
Complicated.
Yeah.
No, John was the star of Whose Line when we joined the show. And he was as kind and as affable, intellectual. He had a formidable intellect and talent and was as easygoing. And I know not what others made of him. And I believe that in the end, everybody really, really loved him. I think he was beloved.
Oh, he was rare funny.
He was, like you say, he was rare funny. I don't know that many people in my life. We met and we had a good meeting and...
Will you do one of his authors?
Yeah.
Please?
Here's, this is a couple episodes in. We used to do the game Authors, which I quite enjoyed. When we did it in the audition, I did Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, my God.
And how do you get any comedy out of that? And I went, listen, this is John Sessions doing Ernest Hemingway. Jack was, what was it? Jack was fishing. His pants were tied. It felt good.
And he would put his leg up when he would do this.
Fred Astaire. Yeah. Whenever he did musicals. John taught me to put your leg up when you do Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire's knees
well,
always
steel, steel focus, right?
Not only was he... he wasn't an Oxbridge performer. He actually came from...
He wasn't from a well-off family.
No.
He went to school in Canada.
Right.
He came back and then was in RADA, the Royal Academy.
He got in dramatic RADA, art. And that's where he met Kenneth Branagh.
And that's how
Who's been nothing but friendly to us and loving
right,
our
but
our
I mean,
lives.
John had, I think... He came at it at a different angle from privileged people.
Which makes him fabulous as a comedian. Also, I would say like Robin Williams, like he's just a errant. He's so funny and so glib and so superbly intellectual and so able to go there. On his solo shows, he would take 20 minutes and do like a character with two objects and a, you know, a name. Like,
I think part of the problem is that society needed a box to put him in, and he couldn't be framed in that fashion.
I feel like that's with a lot of comedians, like Jonathan Winters McShane. There's a bunch of comics who, it's not like that they could do what everybody wanted them to do. It's like they could do what they could do. And show business is this weird kind of exacting thing.
Well, what did Max von Sydow say to us?
Casting directors haven't much imagination after I played Jesus. They wanted me to play Popes of Jesus all the time.
Well, you know...
They don't come at you with a lot of new shit.
No.
They're trying to recreate something that worked. Is it policy? Can we make it work? Can we make it... Yeah. Well, but the... So let's celebrate John Sessions.
Yeah.
He was...
it's
whatever
too soon
he became,
for him to be gone.
One. Absolutely. No, no question. It's way too soon for him to be gone. And whatever he became or whatever he was becoming, I'm not speaking to that. I want to speak to the... Okay, here's one. I went to see him before 94. It was he was doing Tartuffe with Paul Eddington on the West End near the Royal Horse Guards, that theater, the one where Leo McKern played. I can't remember the name of it. and way down near the river and whatnot. Beautiful theater. And Tartuffe, he played Tartuffe. Paul Eddington was the, you know, the grandparent and whatnot. And I went backstage after. I was ushered because I gave my name. And because I gave my name, John let me in. And I came backstage and I said, it was bloody marvelous. I really loved it. Do you have time to go for a drink? And he went, darling, I've got dinner arrangements. It's so lovely to see you. And I remember thinking he was so gracious. And every time we saw him, subsequent to that, of course, and I'm going to say it, yes.
What about
the Groucho Club?
What about the Roddy McDowall story?
Do you want to tell it?
Yeah. So
this is like Martin now. Will you tell it?
Really?
Will you tell it?
Well, it's also like a Loretta story.
Very much so. So John Sessions, we hooked up in Aspen, and we met at some horrible event that was like a big, giant event that everyone, all the comics met at. But because John and Jennifer had a very kind of groovy...
I don't say because he was gay and Jewish and Scottish.
In any case, John was compelled to come with us, and he did. And we went and we had lunch and whatnot, and... he told us all these things, and this is where Jennifer jumps in.
Well, he was invited to a dinner party at Roddy McDowell's.
Did you say Roddy McDowell's?
In Los Angeles.
Lay a little groundwork for Roddy McDowell, won't you?
Roddy McDowell, a fabulous child actor.
Yes.
Adult actor, strangely in Planet of the Apes actor.
All of the Planet of the Apes.
And best friend of Elizabeth Taylor.
Mm-hmm. And photographer.
And he... did home movies. There's online you can see a lot of his home movies.
The stars.
Our friend Mark Crowley and is in several of them. So John was at a dinner party at Roddy McDowell's. Roddy McDowell is also an amazing photographer. There's a really cute photo of Elizabeth Taylor by him.
Was, yeah.
But anyway, so he was at... John Sessions was...
He is, actually.
Yeah. At this dinner party. I think he was kind of selfless that way.
Yeah.
Right? He understood...
He's the right guy.
Other people were...
Very good
the
actor.
The focus
I wouldn't
and not
say the
him.
Greatest actor.
Well, he's campy actor. And fun, isn't he?
He played Augustus in Cleopatra. It's great.
Yes. So John is at this dinner party at Roddy McDowell's house.
Yes.
And, of course, it's full of actresses of different tiers and decades.
Eras, yeah.
And at the end of the evening, John Sessions says to this actress that is departing, "Oh, well, it was so great to meet Maureen O'Hara. I'm so honored." And the woman leaves, and there's a silence. And Roddy McDowell picks up a phone after a few drinks, right? I'm sure there's an interval, right, until the woman gets home. He picks up the phone. He says, "Hello, Maureen Sullivan."
Mm-hmm.
John.
Wait, so the... actress that John called Maureen O'Hara was Maureen O'Sullivan, Mia Farrow's mother.
Yes.
Jane in all of the Tarzan
yes.
movies.
John would like to tell you something. And he just shoves the phone at John. Right. And John is just supposed to be like, "Oh, yeah, about that. I knew who you were. And
I made a mistake.
No, very sorry. Love you to pieces."
Until she...
But I just love that Roddy McDowell didn't even tell him that he was
going to
do that.
Him.
He was going to just force that horrible, awkward moment upon him.
And John did it.
Yeah, he did.
And he told us it in Aspen.
Yeah.
John Sessions was a really lovely human being. You can take that to the bank as, right? As they say. I always felt he was immensely talented. And part of the reason why Whose Line Is It Anyway was as popular as it was.
Well, he was the
because,
first star.
Yeah.
He was...
Him and then McShane and then Ryan and whatnot. It's just an amazing chain. And speaking of, you've been the smartest crowd in the world. I've been the smartest man in the world. Jennifer?
Really?
What?
What?
You've been the smartest woman in the world. May every page that turned to you be a satchel page. May every bell that rings for you be a cool Papa bell. And if you have to buy bonds,